Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing our recent back issue purchases as well as reviewing a classic comic storyline.
In this back issue spotlight, we're going to be celebrating the 300th episode of the Weekly Comics Spotlight by talking about some comics with the number 300. We'll be following the standard format of the Weekly Comics Spotlight, so we'll have a title from DC, a title from Marvel, and a title from some other publisher. With Hellblazer ending at number 300, that made for an obvious and reasonably timely choice for DC. For Marvel, we went back to the well with The Amazing Spider-Man. For the other publisher, well, we decided to go all in with the entire 300 miniseries. That's right, not one, not two, not three, not four, but five issues, well, or in my case, a collected hardcover of the five issues, for the entire 300 miniseries. Now, given that much material to read, we decided to break up the recording into different segments that we recorded at different times. So, with that, let's get going. Our DC title is Hellblazer 300, which is one of the longer-running titles at DC since they've restarted everything else. Now, Bob, I don't know about you. I'm assuming you're current on the title. I have only read issues 9 and 10, and this is 300. So I'm going to be saying I am not up to speed on this series.
I'm not completely current. I mean, I kind of drift in and out of Hellblazer, and I was reading it for a while and not reading it for a while. I mean, I've probably read about half of the issues of the series, and this current run, I started picking it up the last five or six issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I have not read everything. Like, for instance, I was not reading it when he got married to Epiphany, so a little bit unfamiliar with that. I was not reading it whenever the story arcs that introduced his, I guess, niece and nephew.
I was surprised. I didn't realize he had a niece and a nephew.
Yeah.
A little confused about Finn's whole status. Is he really his nephew or not? There are a few things in this issue that threw that into question. Didn't know he was married, but again, not too incredible when you realize I'm a few hundred issues out of date, and really most of my knowledge of the character comes from, like, Swamp Thing, Books of Magic, other places, obviously, since I've only read two issues of this title ever.
Yeah, what I liked about it was, especially in reading this final arc, Death and Cigarettes, this is the third part, I think, of it, ran, I don't know, it's three, maybe four issues, last couple of issues anyway. Milligan has done a good job on, even though I didn't read the issues introducing a lot of these characters, I don't feel particularly lost. I mean, I think he did a good job on giving me the information that I need to have to get into the story and understand what's going on. So I give him a lot of credit for that.
I would agree with that because, I mean, as somebody coming to it completely cold for just the final issue here, there are, again, some places where I had some questions, you know, who are some of these characters, what's the big deal with this, or whatever. And with only one exception, the fact that I was incredibly uninformed about the series status quo wasn't an issue at all. The story made sense, it was engaging, it was entertaining, I was able to follow it, because, again, I was getting pretty much what I needed to understand it, if not get the full context or appreciation of it, for almost everything, again, with one exception.
Yeah, I mean, it's when I read a book like this where the writer obviously cares about how to structure a story,
mm-hmm.
It just makes me more irritated when I read some of these other comics that I get into them, and even if I have been reading it, it's like, what the heck is going on? You know, I mean, this was a last issue, an issue 300, and it was more new reader friendly than at least 50% of the number one issues I read.
That's true.
That's sad, you know, about number one issues, not about this issue. This is a really good issue.
I mean, it would have been completely understandable if I had read this and just had no idea what was going on, what was happening, why it mattered, who these people were, etc. Because this was, again, not only the finale of a story, but of a series. So yeah. You're right. The level of accessibility here, Milligan gets really high marks on that. Again, there was only one thing that really I felt should have been explained here that was not. Whereas everything else, I was able to kind of follow along, and I got taken on a few rides here and there, particularly the revelation on the title page and stuff. It's like, oh, I didn't see that coming and should have. But, you know, it was fun. I was able to get into the story and ride along with it, again, with no background. So high marks for the rider on that.
Yeah, and I really like that. I mean, it's like the last issue, you know, obviously, I mean, I don't want to give too many spoilers, but I mean, part of this story arc is that Constantine dies. And, you know, it's just, you're starting out with, you know, him being dead in this issue. So, mm-hmm. you know, the way that he played with it, and I think he played fair, probably fairer for people who would have been introduced to some of the characters before, but I didn't feel like it was a cheat or anything on any of the elements in this story. I think, you know, some good things happened here, and, you know, it was a good closure to the series. The last page, I think there was lots of, in the bar, a lot of the names on the bottles.
I was going to ask about that. I assume they were all the previous creators.
Yeah, they're all creators who have worked on the series over the 300 issues. So that was kind of cool that they had that in there. But, you know, I thought this was a really well done issue. And even as a standalone issue for people who have not read Hellblazer and is like, oh, what's this all about? I think you can pick up the 300 issue like you did and get a good story out of it. And I applaud Peter Milligan. That is not easy to do, and he did it really well.
I am going to get a little spoiler-ish and talk about the one thing that I thought was a little bit of an Achilles heel for this issue. And that was Angie Spatchcock's one remaining dart. No idea what's special about that dart, what the big deal is, or whatever.
Yeah,
is a key aspect to the scene, particularly the one full page splash where all we see is that dart. So it's clearly a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the deal is with that either.
And to me, that undercut the ending. It's like I saw what happened, I understood what happened, but I didn't understand at all what that meant. And it, going back to that final page, the expression of the one guy in front of the bar was a little, it's like, should I be reading something into that based on this other stuff? Or, I mean, it left me surprisingly perplexed given how the rest of the issue really flowed well for me, made sense for me. And I think there was the time and the space to give a little bit of exposition as to what that dart could do.
That's fair enough. I think that's fair enough. Cause I also didn't really know what the deal was with that.
Cause it, I mean, 3 pages of reactions essentially, or fallout or whatever you want to call of that. And there are a couple of different things I could guess about, but it's just wild conjecture at that point. Again, I loved how that final panel, though, had the names of all, maybe not all, but many of the different creators and stuff that have worked on this series. I thought that was a really nice touch, very respectful to the people who've put all this together. You know, and the name of the bar, Long Journey's End, also kind of appropriate. So, coming at it completely cold, I was very pleasantly surprised how accessible this was. Thought it was a very enjoyable read. They used the pages well, of which they had plenty of pages, and I'm glad they did. I would not have wanted to see this either split into different issues or condensed down. But to me, that ending takes it down a notch. I would have loved to have given this a 5, but I can't. I mean, to me, it's a 4 out of 5 because I didn't get the ending. I didn't understand. I mean, I understood it. I didn't. It lacked any resonance, impact, or meaning to me as to the events. You know, what did I really just see?
Mm-hmm.
Be like going to a piano concert and being deaf. You see the guy's hands flying around. You see people applauding. Clearly, they're loving it, and you're like, well, "What's the big deal?"
I mean, I agree. I mean, I just kind of, I wasn't that affected by that because I just kind of read it and, okay, it must have been some mystical property or something. I mean, I don't know exactly what it did either, which did detract from the ending. But it did something, obviously. So,
it did something and something big.
Yeah.
So.
Something, so, if you're listening to this, and you know
yes,
and want to
explain
it to us.
Please go to our forum, use the new spoiler tag we've got on there, and explain what the heck the big deal is with that dart. Because I would appreciate that.
Because I did go, I looked up Angie Spatchcock on, you know, I put her into the browser, and up comes a wiki page for Angie Spatchcock on the Hellblazer wiki. And I read through that, and it tells me a lot about Angie Spatchcock, but there's no particular mention of a dart, or I'm kind of like, I still don't, I mean, I read through it, and I still don't exactly know what the deal is with it, so.
Yeah, but anytime you've got to go do that kind of research, it's...
I'm sure Damien will be able to tell us.
Quite possibly, hopefully. So Damien, please post on the forum, let us know. Again, though, high marks to Milligan for the accessibility on a final issue. I think there are a lot of people who would have figured, oh, who's going to read just the last issue not knowing what's going on? And it's like, well, basically I did. And I appreciated he had enough respect for me as a prospective new reader and stuff to make this an enjoyable story and an incredibly accessible one. That's the kind of writing we need on all the titles out there. Some where you come in at any point, even near the tail end, and it makes sense.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, when we were talking about what indie book we could do, you know, another series that ended at 300 is Cerebus, the Aardvark. And, you know, when we talked about that, it's like, yeah, but if you just read issue 300, you'd have no idea what was going on because, you know, a lot of stuff built up to that. And it just, I don't, while I liked the series Cerebus, I don't think that the 300th issue would have in any way, shape, or form stood alone, you know, for you and, you know, been something that you could read and get the impact out of it. Whereas this one, much, much different. You know, so now we're going to, you know, get a Constantine number one where he's been folded in, you know, the other Constantine because it's a completely different character, you know, that we've been seeing in Justice League Dark, you know, so that's where the Constantine character will continue. The DC New 52 version will live on and the Vertigo Hellblazer is gone. So, I gave this a 4 out of 5 also, I think a high 4 out of 5, Milligan did an excellent job on this. I liked, Giuseppe Comancoli's art on this. I think it's a good match for the supernatural tone of the series.
Mm-hmm.
I like his storytelling. Very clear, good panel to panel continuity again with the, had we known what that dart was, you know, from the writing. I think that the pacing on that last thing seemed really nice. I was just missing a key piece of information to really have that sink in for me.
Yeah. But the panel with just the dart, or the page with just the dart, really underscores this dart's key.
Yes.
I want to make sure you don't miss that. And it was not gratuitous. It was not overplayed. To me, it was very effective. There was one other panel on that page, though, that I obviously was intentional, but left me a little puzzled, and that was the second to last panel on the previous page.
The black panel.
I wasn't going to say what it was, but okay. So again, not quite sure what's going on there. The whole timing on stuff, because it seems like there's at least a second or two between when the gun's fired and the bullet or the dart flying. So again. Damien, somebody, please go to the forum, start up a thread, explain that aspect of Hellblazer 300. I would appreciate it. Anything else, or shall we move on?
Let's move on to Marvel.
Our Marvel title is Amazing Spider-Man number 300. Now, I don't know about you, Bob, but I had not read this since it first came out around 1998, so 25 yep. years ago.
25 years ago. It's the special 25th anniversary issue. We just had the 50th anniversary of Spider-Man. So, yeah, 25 years. It held up pretty good. There were a couple things about it that were, you know, reading it today, I don't recall having the same thoughts about, you know, about those aspects of the story when I read it the first time. So I think, you know, over that 25 years, I've, you know, just read that many more comics and am a little bit more, you know, questioning when I see certain things.
Such as?
Oh, such as the thing with the bells in the bell tower. You know, it's just Spider-Man's all webbed up to the bell, and it's like just this massive webbing. And it's like, you know, given the properties of the webbing, and it's like really tough and everything, is that clapper really going to just bash through the webbing and smush him? It just seemed like there was so much webbing in there, the thing wouldn't even swing freely. I mean, that
was just...
Well,
it shouldn't have swung freely. The webbing should have cushioned the blow.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Things like that, I mean, I did say, I think I just took them on face value at the time. It was like, oh, he's going to get smushed by the clapper, you know?
25 years ago was a very different time for comics. Around this time, you know, we had gotten the Herculean tasks that Spider-Man would do every once in a while. The, you know, I've got this whole building on top of me, it's going to crush me, I can do this, you know, the I can beat Fire Lord, you know, kinds of moments. So I think this was kind of hearkening to that of, it's an impossible escape, but I can do it anyways mentality. It was a different time for comics, and I think that played better back then than it would have now. Now I think it would have gotten ripped apart on the internet, you know, within moments of being released, if not before then. Right. And it's no better or worse. Yeah.
I dig the big crazy 80s hair going on. A lot of these people, you know, like Mary Jane's got the big, you know, I don't know, hairspray or blow dry or whatever. You know, back in the 80s, girls had the big hair like that a lot. So some of it, you know, I think it looked contemporary then, but it's kind of like when you watch a TV show from the 80s and you're like, yikes, you know, you see what the people are wearing and, you know, some of that stuff. But it's, you know, it held up surprisingly good. I still thought it was a good comic.
It did, but, you know, it is interesting what became dated references and stuff. I mean, I, for one, don't miss the days of newsprint and the limited color palette and stuff. So just the physical presentation felt a little dated, and I'm happier with what we got today. But what I found interesting, I think it was on, like, page... this was back when we had page numbers, by the way. Page 14, Peter's going out, and, you know, Mary Jane said, hey, you should try fashion photography. And he's like, you know, I don't know how many photos MJ wants. I've got 36 exposures out of 200 DX in my camera.
Yeah.
This was back in the days of film.
I thought the same thing when I read that. It's like, yeah, back when Kodak actually had a business.
Hey, it's a dated reference, but who would have guessed that 25 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was just amusing. There were a couple of things.
Using the payphone and stuff, you know, it's like, oh, he's talking about not knowing MJ's calling card number.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that one, but you're right.
I remember calling cards, you know, and all this stuff. Everyone's got a cell phone. It's like, you know, like you don't even, it's hard to even find a payphone anymore. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
And even outside of the context of that, the whole concept of calling cards, you know, which were very popular back then. Now it's like, instead of getting a calling card, you just get a burner cell phone. You know, that's the equivalent.
It's funny how some of that stuff is dated. It surprised me how much of this era of Spider-Man, I mean, I got this off the rack and stuff, but I had just kind of forgotten about. I mean, I'd forgotten how pumped up Eddie Brock was back then. I mean, big, massive, you know, bodybuilder, weightlifter kind of a physique there. And I recall Venom was always big and stuff, but just as Eddie, he was huge. And I thought it was cool how in this issue...
To that point, that's what sort of changed over time, right? Because it made sense that Venom was huge because it was the alien symbiote costume just over Eddie's massive, bodybuilder frame. But over time, it just, like, Venom, when it would go on anyone, it would just kind of like add this crazy mass to them and make them this big thing, you know?
This was before the radical shape-shifting aspect of Venom, because here, the mask has the teeth and the smile and stuff, but not the crazy, you know, fangs and tongue and that kind of ridiculousness that we got later. So I think the character either evolved or devolved, take your pick, over time. But you're right. It's interesting just how much that character has changed over the years. The other thing I had kind of forgotten about was, you know, that Aunt May had run a boarding house for a while.
Yep.
And I thought it was ridiculous how dressed up Mary Jane got for an informal dinner over at Aunt May's. It's like, okay, I know she's a supermodel, but come on.
She likes dressing up.
I guess.
I found it also, it was with the giving kind of the backstory on Eddie.
I was just about to mention that. I like how they recap
many
that.
Many pages and a lot of detail. And it's like, that's kind of the era. They didn't leave as much just kind of unstated or told in pictures. I mean, there was a considerable amount of story going on here. And the part that was of particular interest to me was just how self-deluded Eddie Brock was, because, I mean, it's like, oh, I was a good reporter, except for the fact that, you know, I did absolutely no checking, you know, on this guy who was confessing to being Sin Eater, being a serial confessor and, you know, completely not credible and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
And yeah.
Blaming Spider-Man for this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, come on. You were a lousy reporter. You were never a good reporter if this kind of stuff, you know, slipped past you.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even do a basic check of, does this guy who's claiming to be the Sin Eater, does he have any police record? And if he had checked that, he would have realized, yeah, he's confessed to, you know, everything under the sun or what have you. But I liked how we get a recap both of Eddie's story, but also of the symbiote's story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they covered a lot of ground in this issue. Go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is, to that point, and again, this is stylistic from back in the 80s, right? They were still telling a comic book story, especially a milestone comic book like this, where someone could pick this up and not feel like they were walking into the middle of a movie. Because within this comic book, they have all the bits and pieces of information that you need to know to thoroughly enjoy this story and read and understand this comic book. Whereas today, you get these things and, you know, there's so much left unsaid. They just kind of leave you hanging a lot.
Today, the milestone issue would have been the climax of the story, the showdown between Spidey and the bad guy. Witness Spider-Man 700, which essentially had just that. Whereas here, a ton happens in the story. Now, technically, this is not a done-in-one story. Because the previous issue set up, you know, the threat of Venom and him terrorizing Mary Jane and stuff like that. But even this issue clearly set up that had just happened. That's why Mary Jane's kind of freaked out and all that kind of stuff. So if you hadn't read the previous issue, which I haven't for, say, 25 years or so, this issue still makes perfect sense. In addition to all that, like we already talked about, we get the backstory of the symbiote, we get the backstory of Eddie Brock, Peter and Mary Jane move, which is a little bit of a to-do, you know, Spider-Man encounters Venom for the first time, I mean, we get the showdown, we get a lot of stuff.
A tremendous amount of stuff happens in this issue. 47 pages,
mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, there's a lot of story here, but... You know,
there's a lot of story and there are a lot of pages. So 47 pages, that's 2.5 times what you would get on average today. But even so, this is at least a 6-issue story arc by today's standards, minimum. And even that probably would have stretched out, they probably would have spilled this over the course of about a year's worth of issues today. And I think it works better just slammed into a single, you know, wow, this is a lot, you know, for a single issue.
Yeah, and I'm trying to, so this issue cost $1.50. Whereas a normal comic back then was $1, a Marvel comic, so like the same month, you know, the issue of Alpha Flight that came out that month, I'm just looking, was $1. So this was an extra 50 cents. So an extra 50% added to the cover price, and you got more than twice the number of pages. Compared to today, when you get Spider-Man 700, and you get it's $7.99, so it's, you know, double the price.
I thought the average price back then was 75 cents.
I don't know.
Go to page story page 43 in the ad right before it. Alpha Flight, it's a subscription ad. And they were saying 16 issues, only $9. That's 56 cents a copy versus 75 cents on the newsstand. And Alpha Flight was kind of in that breakup of the higher priced thing. So they were doing different priced issues, titles and stuff back then.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, Daredevil was 75 cents.
Yeah. So I think for a mainstream title like this, it would have been 75 cents. So it's double, but it's also, you know, double the page count. So
how many story pages were actually in the story in Amazing Spider-Man 700? Because most of that story was padded out with backups and fluff, right?
I, off the top of my head, don't recall, but I'm thinking it was around 48, but I could be wildly mistaken.
So maybe
that.
It was about the same, but I mean, it had like way less story feeling in it. But this was a good book. There was some racy stuff going on. So MJ wants Peter to do fashion photography. So, I mean, they only show her feet and her clothes dropping to the floor. But she's like, hey, you know, take some topless shots of me, Peter. And, you know, this is as racy as they got for, you know, the kids. But, you know, she's prancing around in lingerie in various shots. And I mean, yeah, you got sexy girls, you got McFarlane drawing his crazy webbing all over every place, you've got a couple of battle scenes, you got just all kinds of stuff happening in this issue.
Now, what's interesting with McFarlane's art at this point is we've got a lot where there's the detailed background and stuff like that, but there are also a lot where there's like no background. And in the pages, I think it's story page 27, yeah, where we're getting the Sin Eater background and whatnot, we've got that one panel where it's a lack of a panel, technically, you know, no border or whatever, but it's just Eddie, and there's like no floor, no background, no nothing. This was the kind of thing that McFarlane did a lot in Infinity Inc., where they were almost, in this case, it was part of the story, but in the Infinity Inc., it was almost stylistic, where you would have just a pin-up shot of the character along the side of the page or something like that. It's interesting where he would go here with no background, just because it's not needed. Others, he's doing the work, he's got the detailed background and stuff. Today, I don't think we tend to see that as much. It's just different visual style, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, there are quite a few panels that have pretty much no background in them.
True, but there are also quite a few that haven't,
yeah. But I'm just saying, I think it's as much a time saver as it is stylistic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he doesn't overdo it. I mean, it's not like you don't see any backgrounds. He puts enough backgrounds in that you don't feel like you're getting shafted for backgrounds.
Yeah.
But then he has enough panels that have absolutely no background and just, you know, like the headshot or the full body shot or whatever with no background whatsoever that I think he can, you know, save himself a fair bit of time.
But I think a lot of those were also appropriate for lack of background. They weren't needed in those. You know, whereas when Spidey first sees Venom going into the abandoned building and stuff, there's a lot of detail just in that panel and stuff. So it's a nice blend of the two extremes. Whereas there are some comics today that are so devoid of any grounding in any sort of a background, you feel almost lost or what have you. I was, again, very pleased with this issue. I liked it a lot. It really set up Venom as just a serious threat to Spider-Man, just because Brock was so much stronger than Peter. The symbiote both enhanced his strength and nullified Peter's spider sense. And again, this was long before the wild shape-changing aspects of the character, and where the character almost became a caricature of what we see here for Venom. So.
But that's a big reveal, too, where, you know, they kind of play it out over, you know, the large part of the issue that the spider sense doesn't work, for
yeah.
instance.
It takes him a while to kind of clue in as to what's going on and why. But it, and to me, that's part of what added to the amount of story content here is where this issue starts off, what happens in it, and where it leaves off. There's a lot of ground covered. And again, 47 pages versus the average of 20 today, But it's not just 2.5 times the amount of story. It's a denser read in a good way. And I was again very pleased by that. So for me, 4 out of 5.
Strong 4 out of 5 for me.
Shall we move on to our other 300?
Yes.
For the episode now. We technically, I suppose, we didn't cheat. We set the rules, we played by them, and changed them as needed. Finding a other comic that hit issue 300 really limited the number of titles we could pick. Then it had to be one that we were both really interested in talking about, both had copies of or could get copies of, etc. We had talked about Cerebus 300, but I haven't read any of Cerebus, so coming in at the tail end didn't make sense. We could have done one or two others, but the one that just kind of jumped out at me saying, hey, this would be fun to reread, was 300. So we're going to cover 300 1 through 5 here, or technically for me, the hardcover. And man, this hardcover is huge. It's like 13 inches wide, 10 inches tall, because the comic had been nothing but double page spreads, essentially. So they said, fine, let's print those as pages and then do, you know, a book that wide.
Yeah, I really like the landscape format on this because I reread this. I originally read this in the issues, but I have the hardcover. So for the purposes of this episode, I just pulled the hardcover off the shelf and it was the hardcover that I reread for it. And, you know, it works really well.
I reread the hardcover and then I rewatched the movie. And I found both very interesting. You know, we get the same basic story in both. The movie reorders a lot of the events.
A little more linear.
A lot more linear. And it made sense to do that. And they added the subplot with the wife and stuff. But, you know, my sister was watching the movie with me. She has not read, of course, the hardcover. But she was very much pointing out, you know, that shot right there very much looks comic book-y. And of course, you know, you could flip to the page of the hardcover and say, yeah, see? You know, because they very much used the comic as the blueprint for the movie with a, I want to start from this shot and I want to end on this shot, you know, kind of a, or this panel to this panel sort of a deal. And it worked very well as a movie. And just as a comic, I found it very entertaining. I will say that this is one where I really recommend reading in one sitting versus in installments. Because typically when I read something for the show, I'm sitting here taking notes and stuff. And what I was finding is, as I was taking notes for this, part of it is I was getting sucked into the story. It's a fun story. A little gory, a little gross in places, particularly in the movie version.
yeah.
There are a lot of, I'm like shielding my eyes. Ugh, I don't need to see that getting, you know, decapitated or lopped off or whatever. It's like, but when I was taking the notes, there were a couple of things where the issues in and of themselves, it's not that they didn't have any content, but nothing where I felt, ooh, I got to comment on this particular thing. And a lot of it is just the things that I kind of pulled out were, really good lines of dialogues, really good moments or whatever. It's a very effectively told story. And I'm kind of wondering if what we're getting over at Dark Horse now with 47 Ronin is going to make for an interesting, I don't say companion title to this, but something along a similar lines where it's a historic legendary story that they've turned into a very, I don't say iconic or, you know, but a kind of a landmark, you know, telling of it, if you will. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm. I haven't read this in years. So I was happy to reread it. And one thing I find interesting, and I forget from the movie, are they calling it the Hot Gates in the movie?
Yes.
Yeah. And it makes sense because, I mean, it's Thermopylae, right? But Thermopylae means the Hot Gates. And I mean, that's Greek for the Hot Gates. And, you know, since they're taking everything else and they're saying it in English, it wouldn't make sense for them to suddenly be saying Thermopylae. You know, it's just like they're translating everything else from Greek into English. So they translate the place name also. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I clued in on that the first time I read it. But that was kind of an interesting bit, you know, when they're talking about the Hot Gates all the time.
When I was watching the movie version of this, got a little confused. Because at one point in the first issue, we get the one guy who kind of trips and stumbles and gets the nickname of Stumblios or whatever.
Uh-huh, yep.
And he's in the movie, But I had gotten him confused with the captain, his son, who I didn't really recall from the book here. So by the pivotal scene near the end, where Stelios, which is his real name, you know, gets his moment in the story, you know, I kind of thought the character had already been killed off, and I'm like, but how does, I of course got the two characters confused, but, I was, really entertained by the story. You know, I liked how we got the coming of age aspect of Leonidas, but it seemed like the character was like around 50 years old at the time of the story, which seems, I don't know, a little ancient to be leading an army, particularly for, you know, that era of human history or whatever. I thought the life expectancy for particularly a warrior race would have been a little lower and whatnot. But they did a really good job here telling the scene, telling the story, setting the scene. There are a few historical inaccuracies, which my sister commented on during the movie and stuff a few times. Not just the aspect of they slammed, I guess it was the Athenians as the boy lovers or whatever, whereas, of course, you know, the Spartans had similar such proclivities and stuff, to the point where they not only had the homosexuality, but they fought in pairs, and those pairs tended to be lovers, figuring if you're standing by the side and protecting the back of your loved one or whatever, you'll fight even better and stuff. That, of course, totally glossed over in the hardcover in the movie, which, you know, fine, understandable. They're telling an action story, not, you know, anything else. But there were just some great lines of dialogue, some great moments. I just don't know how much of that were Frank Miller and how much of that was just the legendary story. You know,
yeah, I mean, one thing I know is, and again, I haven't watched the movie recently. Since you watched it, you know, recently, you can comment on this. I mean, in the book, they make a point that there's the other forces that are coming along. We've got the Arcadians and Corinthians and et cetera, et cetera. You know, in actual history, you know, there were 300 Spartans, but there were, you know, from probably about 7 or 8 other Greek, I guess, city states they were at the time there at the Battle of Thermopylae. So there were in total about 7,000 Greeks that held off, you know, a considerably larger force of Persians that's estimated, you know, anywhere between 70,000 and several hundred thousand under Xerxes, mm-hmm. which is still pretty impressive. I mean, it's like they were outnumbered at best 10-1 and maybe 20-1 or more. But it seems like that was downplayed in both the book and the movie. You know, that it was more like it was these 300 guys, and then there were some, you know, sissy boys prancing around off in the bushes there a little bit. You know, it's just like,
well, they address that because technically Leonidas couldn't bring his army of the 10,000 or whatever, because, you know, the oracles forbade it because they'd essentially been bought off by Xerxes. And then Leonidas goes for a walk with his 300 bodyguards. And then the Arcadians join up with them, and it's like, you only brought a handful of guys, or, you know, there's a couple hundred. What's up with this? I thought you were going all out against Xerxes. And, you know, we bring all of our people. And the comment was, you know, what are your professions? Oh, you're a sculptor, a blacksmith, a baker, you know, whatever. And, you know, what Leonidas had brought was 300 warriors, 300 soldiers. And both in the book and in the movie, they play up the fact that this is the core of the fighting force. Yes, there are all of these other people who are helping out, doing some flanking maneuvers, but are not expected to be the fighting force, if you will. So certainly it's not that it's just the 300 and nobody else, but that those other guys are not seen as kind of the front runners. They're the guys almost on the bench.
No, and I understand that, and that's how it's played in the book. I think in actual history, it was more like there were quite a few more people, and, you know, it wasn't the only warriors there. Were not just the 300 Spartans. There were warriors from other places as well. But, you know, I think that's, you know, you do that for dramatic effect here, so that's fine.
Yeah, as to how the history went down, I have no idea. My understanding is the other guys had some training, but by and large, they were not full-time warriors. You know, it's not that they were completely, you know, ill-equipped to fight at all, but, again, not trained since birth to do this sort of a thing. But again, it's the Spartans telling the story, so of course they're going to come out on top.
Yeah.
Even if they lose, which they do. I was thinking of, while watching the movie, it'd be really fun to see this same story or the same sort of story told from the other perspective. Because, I mean, there's the old joke of, you know, it was, 700 against an army of thousands. And damned if they weren't the seven toughest guys we ever fought, you know, kind of thing. Same idea here. See what this would look like. Because in the movie, you know, the Xerxes crew are huge. They're monstrous. They're unbeatable. Overblown because this is being told by a storyteller who's trying to make the Spartans out to look good. And seeing kind of a counterpoint of the same story told to the other side, trying to explain, yeah, we just got kind of our butts handed to us by this really small crew comparatively, how they would have kind of embellished the story to make them not look so bad or what have you. I think there's a lot of fun potential there. But it's interesting the use of silhouettes in the comics, again, the widescreen aspect of it, and just a lot of the key visuals and how well they were replicated in the movie, and how effective they were on both sides of the equation. There are a lot of comics I think if you were to do a very faithful adaptation to would fall flat in a couple of areas because certain things work on the page, not on the screen. But they did a good job, leveraging what worked and tweaking what needed to be tweaked. Certain aspects of this story were told the way they were because it was serialized over five individual issues. End of the first, let's flash back to why we go to war. In the second, let's explain why only 300. Because the whole story in the comic starts with them already marching to war. Or going for the walk, depending on which political view you want to take. Whereas in the comic, or not the comic, in the movie, I mean, again, they tell a much more linear story. They start with this coming-of-age story. They then explain the what leads to war. Then they go off to war, that kind of a deal. And that, as a single-installment movie, is a much smarter plan. Whereas if you're doing it spread across five comic book issues, you want to have a little in each and build the story that way. So, great stuff. Gorier and more violent than I care for, but definitely a classic work. I think the use of the double page spreads to give it that widescreen, almost cinematic aspect plays very well on the page, and again, you know, made it very easy to leverage into a movie.
Yeah, I would say that if you haven't seen the movie, see the movie. If you haven't read the book, I would highly recommend. I mean, it's available. I'm pretty sure it's still in print. Get a copy of the book and read it. I mean, I would say...
If it is not in print, Mike Richards should be fired from his own company.
Let me do a quick Amazon search.
It's got to be in print. If you haven't read this, I recommend picking up the hardcover, reading it, and then watching the movie. Because...
Yeah. Doing the book first is good. Yeah, and it is. It's you can buy it at it's $19.80 in hardcover from Amazon.
Yeah, I figured it had to be. Fun stuff, good to do. Again, huge physical book, but great presentation of it. Again, I didn't read it when it came out. I don't know how the individual chapters would work as standalone. I think they would have worked well. For me, it worked very well in a single sitting with a hardcover. It's got the scope and story size to really kind of work. I was very pleased.
Yeah, I remember enjoying it back when I read it in the individual issues. I liked it well enough to do the double dip and buy the hardcover. And, you know, again, it's probably been, you know, good 8 years at least since I've read it. When did the movie come out?
I'm thinking
2007, I guess. I'm looking right now.
5-6 years ago, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so that's probably, so let's say 6 years, because I reread the hardcover when the movie came out, before I went and saw the movie. So, that was the last time I read it. But it's the kind of a story that, you know, you can read every few years. I mean, and I appreciated it as much now as the last time I read it and the first time I read it. It's just, it's one of those things that's a timeless classic, I think, you know.
Yeah, I very much think so too.
This is Frank Miller. This is a good example of Frank Miller being the Frank Miller that has made him famous, right?
Yeah.
This is just a quality piece of work from start to finish.
It's an easy read. It's very accessible, approachable. Whereas a lot of other things that are kind of heralded as classics and stuff in comics tend to be very dense reads, Watchmen being a good example of that. To me, this is something that you can read through at a surprisingly brisk pace, given the page count and such.
I spent a little over an hour on it, I think. Maybe about an hour and 15 minutes reading through it.
I'm thinking I spent closer to about 45 minutes, give or take, and that included taking some notes. Again, what I found is, in a lot of comics, I'm stopping and it's like, oh, wait, you know, hang on a sec. I gotta type this note up of, you know, why did they do this? This struck me as funny. This really worked or whatever. Whereas with this, there were a couple of things that, I mean, the notes I have on this are really minimal, and it comes down to a couple of lines I really loved. You know, at the coming of age, he'll return as a Spartan or not at all. You know, some very, you know, things that make great sound bites in the movies, you know?
Yeah, I love the line. It's in the book and in the movie of, you know, our arrows will blot out the sun, so we'll fight in the shade, you know.
Yeah, that was
basically
one of the ones.
That's a great line. I spent longer probably because I just, on some of these images, I just spent some time just looking at all the detail that he's got in the image. I mean, he's just got, there's stuff going on in some of these big images.
I could easily see spending some time if there were, and I don't think it's a special feature on the DVD. I don't know if it'd be on the Blu-ray or not. I would love to see them do a comparison of the book to the comic, both in terms of the order the book was told and the order the comic was, or the movie was told versus the comic and such. Because there are a couple where, man, they captured the iconic panel image, if you will, in a couple of key places a lot of times, and just amazingly, you know, brought the comic to life in a very effective manner.
Well, it's interesting because there are several places in the comic where Miller uses the silhouetting technique, where, you know, it's just like kind of the black silhouettes against a somewhat lighted background. I mean, those are the kind of things that, you know, you can really, you do an image like that in the movie and it can look fairly identical. You know, you have the people silhouetted. You know, because there it's like you can't even differentiate, you know, the drawing details from the reality because you're seeing the silhouette against the background.
But well, again,
it works well
the...
in both media. And that's another thing there is it's surprising how well, you know, his storytelling in this graphic format translates the film extremely well.
Again, the major changes was the ordering of some of the scenes to be in a more linear fashion, and the addition essentially of a subplot, which was hinted at in the comic with the Xerxes having bought out Ephors or Ephors or whatever.
Yeah, the priests.
The priests, yeah.
That maintain the oracle.
Fun stuff. For me, very strong 4 out of 5. Definitely recommend it.
It gets a 5 from me. This is a classic. Completely well done.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.